Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Tensions between the United States and North Korea have been rising in recent weeks, with both countries showcasing their military capabilities through various exercises. Here to discuss the issues are Stephen Lebo of the Sage Colleges and Christopher Clary of UAlbany's Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy. And we would like to hear from you today. It's a call-in show. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You may also email the questions or comments you may have to voxpop@wamc.org. It's voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to as many emails as we can. But calls are paramount here on this call-in show. 800-348-2551. We talk North Korea next after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Tensions continue to rise between the U.S. and North Korea. Today, North Korea marked the 85th anniversary of the Korean People's Army with an artillery exercise. Meanwhile, the U.S. 7th Fleet says two of its destroyers are conducting maritime exercises with naval ships from Japan and South Korea today and tomorrow. The U.S. Navy said the exercises demonstrate a shared commitment to security and stability in the region and underscore America's flexibility in combining with allied naval forces in response to a broad range of situations. Members of the Trump administration are scheduled to brief the Senate tomorrow about North Korea's nuclear program, the readiness options for the U.S., and the state of diplomacy. Here to discuss all of that and the situation on the Korean Peninsula are Stephen Lebo of the Sage Colleges and Christopher Clary of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University at Albany. Stephen is the Sherman David Specter Professor of International History and Politics at the Sage Colleges, an associate in research at Harvard University, a prolific author. He specializes in the relationship between Asia and the West. He's also a WAMC commentator. Christopher Clary is an assistant professor of political science at the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy. His research focuses on the causes and consequences of nuclear proliferation, U.S. defense policy, and the politics of Asia. He served as a foreign policy analyst in the office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs from 2006 to 2009. It's a long introduction, but we still have a few minutes left in the show. Stephen Lebo and Chris Clary, welcome up. Welcome to have you here. Nice to have you guys here.
It's good to be here again.
Thank you. Number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email the program voxpop@wamc.org. Seems like a, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but certainly an interesting turn of events that tomorrow the entire Senate is coming to the White House ostensibly to talk about Korea and other issues. Chris Clary, have you seen the like of this before?
You know, it's not by any stretch of the imagination the first crisis the United States has had with North Korea, even in the long history after the armistice. In the mid-90s, the Clinton administration got very close to actually striking North Korea at an earlier stage before they developed nuclear weapons. The Trump administration has a difficult challenge. There's really not a lot one can do without starting a serious war in Asia, one that could probably devastate South Korea as well as U.S. allies in Japan and elsewhere. So what they do is a lot of bluster and try to show action to make threats to North Korea more credible, try to slow North Korean development of an intercontinental ballistic missile, as well as try to prevent additional rounds of nuclear tests. So without real action, you have to do these sort of faux events, and bringing the entire Senate to the White House might fit that bill.
You know, you mentioned the Clinton administration, and there was a great piece in the New York Times yesterday about this sort of incremental progress that has happened with Korea's nuclear program since then, and presumably even before then. And now it would seem, at least according to this piece in yesterday's Times, that we are almost at a tipping point where there are so many nukes and the capability of creating them is so much quicker now for North Korea that it's thought by some that you got to stop it before intercontinental ballistic missiles become a real possibility here.
Well, let me, you know, in terms of your initial question, and let's start with that. You know, what's different and what's the same? On the core question, I think, of the Senate coming to, going to the president rather than the president or senior officials going to. I think this really tells us much more about how little the president himself is embedded in the tradition and history, both of the relationship between the executive branch and the House, and, of course, as a reality TV show person coming up on his 100 days. So I don't think that in itself tells us very much, except in as much as it talks about a president with very little foreign policy experience, who basically brags about how little he understands history in general, who is not, as we have seen, particularly well-staffed. I mean, in what we've seen, basically, is that while there are some people who have significant experience, an awful lot of the foreign policy establishment isn't there helping out. Normally, with the transition, Obama to Trump, there's kind of like a Democratic establishment in foreign policy, and then there's kind of a Republican one, and they go in, they go out. An awful lot of those people on the Republican side did not become part of the new administration. You have a lot of positions that have not been filled. So in that sense, you have an American administration that is the real question here. I've been communicating with a South Korean historian over the last few minutes. They're much more nervous about Donald Trump than they are Kim Jong-un. So, and going to the other question you were talking about, the bottom line is that in the mid-1990s, after that confrontation between Kim Jong-il and the Clinton administration, there was a movement towards some kind of compromise. There were recognition of their problems with energy, with food, and we were starting to make progress.
Giving them energy aid.
And you had the relationship between South Korea involved. Kim Dae-jung of South Korea was very interested in improving relations. The Clinton administration was. Madeleine Albright went there, as you'll recall. When George W. Bush came into power, most of that fell away. And that was probably the last point when this North Korean administration seemed to be willing to try to piece its way out of the circumstance of isolation they found themselves in. And what's happened since then? The United States has invaded and taken down the Taliban in 2001. They took down Iraq in 2003. We played a role in bringing down Gaddafi. If you are in North Korea today with that kind of memory, you're not going to want to back off on nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons provide a sort of survival insurance to a regime. And all of these threats that the Trump administration is issuing in order to try to scare North Korea into slowing its developments also reinforce the benefit of having nuclear weapons for that North Korean regime. It's difficult to get out of this spiral of threats and counter-threats. And in the past, we've gone to diplomacy, but it is also the case that the Clinton administration, which created this agreed framework setup, whereby North Korea had certain obligations in exchange for United States and other international assistance.
Which they reneged on, correct?
Well, there was...
Depends on who you ask.
There were mistakes on both sides. The United States certainly dragged its feet in terms of implementation, and it is also the case that at some point, North Korea, which had promised to basically give up the plutonium route to the bomb, one of two ways you can get nuclear-grade material, decided to go another way. They decided to develop a secret uranium program, importing some secret technology from Pakistan during the time. And the Bush administration caught them. The U.S. intelligence community caught them. And rather than try to repair that diplomatic arrangement, they decided to call it. And you got a situation where those diplomatic moves that had slowed North Korean nuclear development stopped and never really recovered, right? The Obama administration practiced this policy of strategic patience, having these sanctions cause some sort of harm to North Korea, slowly over time trying to convince them that there was more to benefit from coming back into the community of nations. But again, that survival insurance that nuclear weapons provide was just too compelling to the North Korean leadership.
Let's back up, though. Near the end of the Bush administration, they attempted to again try to re-engage with North Korea. We've gone back and forth. But if you are sitting in power in North Korea, and you're saying, and you're hearing all of this tension, and you're saying to yourself, Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons, and if Gaddafi had not started moving away from them, he wouldn't have had the fate that he ended up with. But let's add, I think, one really important feature that's going on here. First of all, as I said, we have an inexperienced administration in the United States, more experienced administration in North Korea, which has managed to eliminate or kill an awful lot of the senior people whose experience goes back for generations. And in the middle of all this, South Korea has just impeached and gotten rid of their president, and they're in the middle of a presidential campaign. So if you're talking about a circumstance which is more potentially dangerous than usual, we are at it.
It seems to me we haven't mentioned once the real power player there, and I would assume that to be China, with a flick of a finger, could make this go away.
No.
Really?
No. The Chinese do not have anywhere near the influence that people think they have in North Korea. They have a fair amount, and they have pushed various buttons and economic pressures and things of that sort. But the Chinese do not have that same kind of power, and they have the problem of thinking, if we really impose a lot of power, what happens if North Korea collapses? North Korea is a horrendous dictatorship where people are held in power there by fear in large measure. It's the kind of circumstance that could look incredibly stable in one second and just explode in the next. And China does not want that kind of chaos. So China's ability to really impact the situation is not what people think that we normally hear about.
We're joined today by Stephen Lebow of the Sage Colleges and Christopher Clary of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs. Given the situation in North Korea, and we can only see little glimpses of it, wouldn't the populace welcome the Chinese with open arms if they said, okay, we've had enough, we will now make sure that the show is run properly? And they came right in, right over the border.
You know, pressure is hard to exert in a situation like this. You definitely have this fact that if China were to cut off petroleum exports to North Korea,
allegedly they're doing,
to shut down the energy supply, in order to cause enough pain to a regime to change a core policy, you have to be willing to inflict enough pain that you might actually cause that regime to collapse and lash out in some way. And it's not just the prospect of the refugee crisis. That's probably manageable. The People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, is very large and could probably find some way. There's some speculation in the Chinese press in the last few days about how to set up refugee camps on the North Korean side of the border. It is also the case that a collapse in the North Korean regime could lead to a unified Korean peninsula. And, oh, by the way, a unified Korean peninsula where there are lots of Korean scientists that have been working on nuclear weapons for the last decade, right? So that's not in China's interest either.
Well, let's take a break here, gentlemen. We've got to take a quick break for underwriting. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Stephen Lebow and Chris Clary here, and you. And we'll get to the calls and the emails and the show just getting rolling. Hang in there.
Support for WAMC comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale Retail Shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington, janeiredale.com. Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. The Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presents Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, a farce about identical twins separated at birth through April 30th, newpaltz.edu/theater. And ClipCentric Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.clipcentric.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, joined today by Stephen Lebow and Christopher Clary, and you at 800-348-2551. Now, Stephen, before we get to the phones, you wanted to follow up on the last topic.
Well, the comment, you know, you asked a question about whether people in North Korea, given the horrendous circumstances, I mean, they're basically living in a kind of large concentration camp, wouldn't they be pleased to have the Chinese come aboard? But I think, frankly, anyone who's listening to me and who's picking this up from Canada will appreciate what I'm going to say. A good part of people's identities in East Asia and in South Asia, from Vietnam to China, is about not being Chinese. There's an awful lot of nationalism on the Korean Peninsula. And so I wouldn't assume at all that the Koreans and North Koreans would be particularly happy if the Chinese arrived.
All right, our number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And this one came in from Eric in Shelburne Falls, who says, given the increasingly palpable threat the DPRK's nuclear program poses both to the U.S. and to China, would it make sense for them at least to discuss the option of a joint U.S.-Chinese military intervention, possibly including an agreement to divide the DPRK into occupied spheres along the lines of post-war Europe? Is there any realistic chance such a joint contingency plan is in fact taking place? And that's from Eric in Shelburne Falls.
There's been sort of tacit bargaining on this for some time because there's not that many places on the planet where these great powers can bump up against into each other. And there is a desire by the United States to try to at least seize all of the nuclear weapons-related facilities very quickly. Mm. And we also suspect there's probably chemical weapons-related facilities in North Korea as well. So try to get control of those very rapidly. And obviously, since the Korean War escalated when U.S. and Chinese signals at trying to prevent the United States and U.N. forces from getting too far north led to Chinese intervention, led to a tremendous number of casualties on both sides. This is in both of our interests. But it's very challenging for China to sort of explicitly negotiate on these measures. What does appear is there have been increasing signals in the last week out of Beijing and elsewhere that China might be willing to step out of the way, that have sort of diplomatic condemnation of a U.S. military action that they still stress is unwise, contrary to what they believe are U.S. interests and certainly contrary to Chinese interests, but not so unwise that they believe that China would need to militarily defend its North Korean partner.
Well, the first obvious thought is to you don't want to start a war in order to avoid a war. But there could be nothing, shall we say, more concerning than the idea of having an ascendant China, particularly under Xi Jinping, which has been more nationalistic, more authoritarian, dividing up a Korean peninsula with the United States. That would put our two forces directly next to each other in an extraordinarily dangerous circumstance. In this context, it's kind of helpful for us to have North Korea between the United States and China. No, I mean, there's no question that the kind of assault that was just described is more dangerous and problematic than allowing the situation. We have lived for an awful long time with, well, the Chinese having nuclear weapons. We were quite nervous in 1964 when Mao Zedong's regime put it in. Pakistan has enormous number of nuclear weapons.
About 100.
Mutually assured destruction has worked out pretty well and kept the world terribly safe. Trying to go into that kind of regime with a massive army, it's about 30 miles from Seoul. There's the real danger, is seeing North Korea lashing out at South Korea. I was like in a traffic jam on a bus. It was still only a few minutes to Panmunjom from downtown Seoul. No, we don't want to go that route.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. And Marta in Poughkeepsie has been waiting a good long time. Marta, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thank you.
Sure.
First of all, thank you for letting me talk.
Sure.
South and North Korea, I feel like they're being kicked around like some kind of football, you know, with the war games constantly on the rise. Those new missiles the U.S. put on the border, they're making North Korea even more paranoid. It didn't start with this administration. It's like the gentleman said earlier, where, you know, millions of people starved in North Korea while we were putting sanctions on them so nothing can get in. China's definitely putting on the squeeze from what I can understand. I'm lucky enough to watch a channel on my television called Arirang that is from Korea. And I'm wondering, where is the Korean voice in this discussion? Because what I'm hearing sounds a lot like a movie I just watched last night that I got out of the library called War Dogs, that this is all about like salivating over what the next huge missile or bomb will be that we can drop before we, you know, like one of you guys said, let's not start a war to stop a war. This stuff that's going on in the Middle East is a disaster, and it's cost us billions of dollars, and now we can't wait to destroy this tiny little place called South and North Korea. I think it's horrible. And, you know, this election, thank God you mentioned that, is a big deal. The first woman president of Korea is now facing jail. What a concept. Presidents who commit crime should go to jail. And it turns out she had a father that was a president, and there were people in her family that had to go to jail before her, and other Korean presidents have gone to jail. And there's a feeling in South Korea that they don't want corrupt government anymore, and a lot of those candidates represent a big change. The only woman who's running for president is talking about a 35-hour work week. Wow. You know, I heard the average hour work day for South Koreans is 18 hours a day. You know, life there is hard. It's crowded, and it's much harder in North Korea. And I don't see where the U.S. is doing anything to help anybody. And Eleanor Roosevelt said it years ago, when people have what they need, it's good for everyone. When everyone has what they need, it's good for everyone. What a concept.
Okay. Hey, Marty, you want to stick around while these guys comment here?
Sure, if you let me.
Actually, I was thinking the people in Poland would completely agree with you. I mean, Korea has played the role of Poland in that sense of being where the major powers have come into conflict and played and fought over the future of the peninsula in this particular case.
South Korea has been subject to the potential of enormous destruction from North Korean military and now from nuclear weapons for a long time. And it's always a challenge for allies in Korea or Japan when the United States starts to care, when the missiles start to put us in range, and we start doing a dance that suggests that we might want to get into a fight over it.
I haven't heard that North Korea has been blowing things up in South Korea. They even had a business corridor that they were working together on.
Actually, unfortunately, North Korea has attacked ships of South Korea. They have sent in submarines that have landed on the coast of South Korea, killed various people. They have, on a regular basis over the years, recently and in the past, assaulted South Korea.
I'm surprised, because Arirang News didn't say anything about it. And they
can
assure
you, I have a book in front of me where I chronicle this every 12 minutes.
The Southeast Asia World Today series, by the way, which is now out.
It comes out in August, and then next August it comes out every year.
Very exciting. Good.
But no, I think there's...
Just to clarify.
Let me add one more core thing. If you want to go, what is this really all about? A couple of points here. It's about insecurity. It's about psychological insecurity. And you know the old line, it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you. North Korea feels itself isolated. It has always been isolated. They made an effort under Kim Jong-il late 1990s to move out of that. They're opening up embassies, visit places. It didn't work. And now they see the major country, which has been challenging it on a regular basis because of its effort, as it sees, to defend itself, having already taken out a bunch of other countries. So you have, number one, North Korea feeling insecure. You also have an American administration, which in itself is feeling like it's the 100 days. The president has been, we've heard a million times, the president doesn't have much understanding of international issues, questions different kinds of long-standing relationships. And we have the Trump administration looking to look strong. That's why you call the senators up to the White House. So an awful lot of this has nothing to do with political science. It's psychology.
But it has nothing to do with the possibility
it's psychology.
That ICBMs could hit the West Coast with nukes very soon.
But let us point out, people keep talking about San Francisco or Hawaii.
Yeah, or
Anchorage,
Seattle.
Anchorage, Alaska is a whole lot closer to North Korea.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe Jeff Sessions isn't sure if Hawaii is part of the United States, but the last time I looked, and I got a lot of relatives there, the Anchorage, Alaska
is
a lot closer. Well, really the core issue here is, don't try to think about this rationally. If you think about the history of wars over the last 150 years, some wars have started because a particular person made a decision. But wars break out all the time for no rational reasons because somebody at a low level, the colonel here or there, makes a mistake. We have rising tensions. And let me add one more thing. On one hand, South Koreans right now are, frankly, more nervous about Donald Trump because they're not sure what he represents than they are Kim Jong-un. But at the same time, a couple of hours ago, the South Korean government sent out messages to the young men, I think it was just men, but I'm not sure about that, in South Korea for the first time, telling them where to show up if a national emergency begins.
Uh-huh.
This just was sent out a few minutes ago, and I was just told this by a 22-year-old South Korean a few minutes ago.
Chris.
He had never gotten something like that.
Deterrence is very unpleasant. And the reality is that the United States' freedom for action may never have been present, even in the 1990s. And it certainly hasn't been present, in my estimation, since 2006, when the nuclear weapons program really got off to the races. And now we're kind of in this weird cycle of grief where 11 years probably after we really had any chance to do something about this, we're flailing against the reality that we'll be in a situation when a missile could reach the United States, but for a long time, vital U.S. interests have been exposed to North Korean risk. And we have to operate like we did with China in the 1960s under Mao, like the Soviet Union under Stalin in the 1950s. There's lots of unpleasant people that have had nuclear weapons,
yeah.
And they've all decided not to pull the trigger
now,
because the devastation would be certain and swift.
Is the difference here only in my perception that at least with the Russians in the 50s and 60s and the Chinese in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that at least they were somewhat stable. You knew who your enemy was, and you more or less knew, you know, mutually assured destruction being what it is, probably there weren't going to be nukes flying. But is the wild card the madman in Pyongyang?
There, you know, the perceptions of Mao in the 1960s were identical, if not considerably worse, than the young Mr. Kim today.
Do you think Mr. Kim today is stable?
At least as stable as Mao. There was a civil war in China in the 1960s, where nuclear weapons establishments were somewhat under duress from these Red Guards, right? This is millions and millions, tens of millions of people died in China in the 1950s and 1960s because of infighting in China. There's no way that was in a different era when media was different. The United States and the Soviet Union both at different times and sometimes together considered an attack to try to get rid of Chinese nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, they decided it was too hard. And that, I think, is what will happen here now with North Korea.
Too much collateral damage.
There is a one big difference.
Yes.
The Taiwan Straits are relatively, you know, large, and Poland was between the Western forces, maybe Berlin a little bit closer. But what we have is an enormous, large army in North Korea that is a few minutes' drive from the capital of one of the major American allies.
Right.
It is nothing. I've taken a city bus.
Right.
That. And we did not have anything like that in those kind of confrontations. The ability to exert pressure on our allies in South Korea is enormously greater than China throwing a few missiles toward Taiwan occasionally when they were having an election. It's a very, very different situation. It's much more volatile right now. And I think that it's particularly significant that we have more uncertainty in South Korea right now. There's an awful lot of inexperience floating around, and mistakes happen.
We are joined today by Stephen Lebo of the Sage Colleges and Christopher Clary of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University at Albany. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. We go to Joe in Delmar. Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'd like to thank your guests because I really think they're giving a different perspective than we hear on the major news media today. I know there's a lot of vilification of the leadership in North Korea, and vilification of leadership in any country has always led to war from us. But there's real reasons, and the last guest said this, that they have to fear the United States. Besides all the wars that we've gone to in recent years, you know, we're putting THAAD missiles in South Korea, which is being opposed in massive ways by people in South Korea. There's been huge demonstrations. The Korean War maybe killed one-third of their population. We destroyed just about every building that stood, and then we started bombing the dams, which is an international war crime. And yet the forces, you know, the United States, who was leading the UN forces, did that. And we have war games all the time there. The war games, the most recent, had 250,000 men right on their border. We had flyovers of the area with planes carrying nuclear weapons. And so you'd understand why they would want to have some kind of deterrent, because they fear the United States. And I think they have good reason to fear the United States, but you never hear that in this country. All you hear is there is a crazy person up there, and we have to all fear him. And that fear has always led to war.
Okay, so Stephen.
Well, but I think what bothers me about the way, let's say, the American mainstream media talks about this is it's always about us and whether North Korea will send a nuke our way. The people that are most in danger relative to North Korea are the North Korean peoples. That regime is a horrendously oppressive regime that has almost no competition. Burma, for a while there, they backed off Myanmar, things of that sort. But the life and what people have had to live in and experience in North Korea, except that small elite that lives, you know, in the capital, is absolutely horrendous. And frankly, I wish there were more Americans more concerned about helping not only North Koreans, but the North Koreans who get across the border into China, who end up in China as illegal aliens, women going across being sold into brothels, sold into forced marriages. There is the real tragedy on the Korean Peninsula.
Chris.
There's a great collection of stories of North Korean refugees that have fled to other parts. And the title is Nothing to Envy, right? The life in North Korea is bad. And it may be the case that Kim Jong-un is a bad person, that his regime is a bad regime, that they do lots of despicable things. And it may also be the case that there's nothing we can do about it in any meaningful way. So instead, it's trying to minimize the damage and also not get into a situation where we scare him and his senior leaders so much that they do something rash, that they fear that war is inevitable and it's better for them to go early rather than later.
So then what do you in fact do if we, and I don't know if it's true or not, that the nuclear program that they have is accelerating, and more importantly, the miniaturization of the nukes and the improvement of the ICBMs is moving along at pace. If we take that as written, I have no reason to take it as written, but that's what I hear. What do you do then? Do you apply pressure? Do you let it go? What do you do? This is, and listen, Stephen, I must take some exception. You know, if your house is the one, you have to be concerned about what happens to your house first. It's human nature. It is, if there is a threat to you, to your house, to Stephen Lebo's house, Stephen's going to be concerned about that first and foremost before he's worried about anything else. It's human nature.
Except in this particular case, even if they develop, and they will, and we are not really in a position to exert the kind of pressure that would make them back off, we end up with that same terrible, awful circumstance that all of us grew up in. It's called containment, mutually assured destruction, and we have far more nukes than they do. And that is, in the end, our situation. We are not in a position. If we were, there was some logical, rational way to put enough pressure on North Korea. A place like Iran, in its circumstance, was the kind of regime that we could have put pressure on and come to the Iranian deal, and that was reasonable. North Korea is not in the same circumstance. There is nothing we can do to get North Korea to back off.
There are still some tools in the toolkit, and we can talk about those in a bit.
We'll do that right after we take a quick break here. It's Vox Pop on WAMC, Christopher Clary and Stephen Lebo, and you at 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Interactive Media Consultants, LLC, celebrating 20 years providing websites, branding, social media, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond. iMediaConsult.com. The Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butterscratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. The Discovery Center, presenting National Natural Landmark, an exhibit exploring sand dunes in the Albany Pine Bush, showing how they were formed and how to protect them, albanypinebush.org. And Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores, Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Our number is 800-348-2551. Stephen Lebo and Christopher Clary, our guests today. And our email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This is the segment of the show I like to call Shameless Self-Promotion. And Stephen Lebo, who knew that you were a fiction writer? I didn't know that.
I hide in the past because sometimes the present is too terrifying.
Right. So this is great. A new book is called Beyond the Heavenly Kingdom. And this is quite a whopper of a piece of fiction.
It's a sequel to a book I wrote on the Chinese Civil War of the 1860s. But this one is about, you know, Mark Twain used to like to say supposedly that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes all the time. Well, 140 years ago in the 1880 election, the American presidential election was totally turning on the issue of whether we should close down immigration to America by an ethnic group. The Chinese. It resulted in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. This is a novel about the past. And ironically, I started before this recent presidential campaign. It's a battle about the present. The point when America, this nation of individuals and immigrants coming from all over the place, in its first moment in the 1880s, decided to close the doors to one particular ethnic group. And of course, we're doing it all over again. And this time, they're not Chinese, they're Muslims.
Do you like writing fiction?
I love writing fiction. It's kind of like flying if you spend all your time driving a car.
Yeah.
I don't write fiction. I write historical fiction.
Right.
It's built around the idea. It's like history with sugar. I'm teaching history, but I'm also having fun in putting in, the Forrest Gump kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're writing about real historical things, and you plug in other people. So in this thing, I've got everybody from Emma Willard and Russell Sage to Ulysses Grant and Mark Twain, major characters. But they're all built around the American battle over excluding the Chinese, which we did for almost 100 years.
Okay, the new book is called... And so when you're writing this, you take all your historical chops and then you bottle of absinthe and then you just sit down with the typewriter?
Yeah, and as I said, having done both, I think of it as like when you're getting out of a car and you get into a plane and you can go more dimensions. It's fun.
Yeah, I like to...
It's a great escape.
Go to other dimensions. Beyond the Heavenly Kingdom is the new book. And also you're going to be appearing... Later this week.
Thursday night.
At an event of fighting climate change in the age of Trump.
I'll be giving a talk on that. It's sort of like building up the momentum for the People's Climate March Saturday.
Yeah. Okay. Well, where is that?
Bush Memorial in Troy.
Okay.
7:00. It's free, open to the public.
All right. Fighting climate change in the age of Trump with Stephen Lebo. Our guests today, Stephen Lebo and Christopher Clary. And let's go back to the phones. Oh, you had mentioned, Chris, there are some tools in the kit that we can still use to apply some pressure here.
You know, the Obama administration had a policy of strategic patience with North Korea, right? Trying to wait it out, see if there was a change in regime that was willing to go a different path. Ultimately, Trump's going to probably have to rebrand strategic patience. You apply some more sanctions. There's discussions of what are sometimes called secondary sanctions. You try to penalize Chinese companies, especially, that are still doing business in North Korea. After these missile tests, sometimes the South Koreans or others, we can go out there and drag up a floating missile carcass out of the ocean. And we do that, and we find there's all sorts of Chinese electronics on the inside.
Mm.
So there are things we can do to target it at specific firms that can slow down the development. And when you buy time, you have the chance that either diplomacy will work or you get a peaceful change in regime that leads to in a better direction.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Robin, who is on the thruway. Robin, you're on.
Yes, I think the concern of Americans needs to be the fact that we have a lunatic in the White House who we have the largest nuclear arsenal of any country. This man is more unstable than anyone. He's being provocative, moving American nuclear-powered ships into the Korean Peninsula. What is North Korea to think after he drops the mother of all conventional bombs on Afghanistan? When he doesn't know which country he bombed, he said he bombed Iraq when he bombed Syria. This is the unhinged person that we Americans need to be more concerned about. And it's hypocrisy to talk about them and their nuclear weapons in Korea when, again, we have the hugest nuclear arsenal of any country, the hugest military of any country, and we have the most unhinged person leading the nation of countries anywhere.
Okay.
And he's even crazier than the North Korean leader.
Well, that's a stretch.
That's what we need to be worried about.
All right, Robin, thanks a lot. And what do you say, folks?
Well, I've never met either one of them. I can only report that about 10 minutes ago, a South Korean political science specialist told me that the people in South Korea are more nervous about Trump than Kim Jong-un.
All right, so that's anecdotal, but we'll take it as
written. He's an academic who does this for a living.
Yeah,
it's anecdotal as much as I am,
okay,
and we
are. Fair enough.
Well, whether or not one individual is crazier than the other, it is certainly the case that if you have one crazy person with a gun, the situation doesn't get any better when there's another crazy person with a gun.
Well
I
played.
Like that.
Well played, Clary. All right, back to the phones. Margaret in New Paltz. Margaret, you're on.
Hello. I was very upset to hear one of your guests say we should be concerning ourselves with the oppression of people of North Korea. I have just been reading
the accusation by somebody named Bondi, forbidden stories from inside North Korea. And my heart goes out to them. But every time we try to save the people of a country from their oppressive governments, we get into a war that makes everyone in a worse condition.
Well, actually, I would agree with that. But that isn't what I was referring to. The fact of the matter is a lot of North Koreans are passing into China, where they have a horrendous, horrific circumstance as well. And then they pass out of China and they come out through Southeast Asia and then they end up in South Korea. There's an organization called Liberty in North Korea that is very involved in helping North Koreans reestablish themselves in South Korea. I have been very involved in working with them. That's what I meant, not going in like the Saddam Hussein sort of thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Christopher Clary and Stephen Lebo and Cindy in Queensbury. Cindy.
Yes. The reason I call is Russia's not exactly right next door, but certainly an interested party. What's your take on them interfering if China backs off?
Russia's considerably more peripheral to this current crisis than China, Japan, South Korea, or the United States. Obviously, the Trump administration has themselves in a bit of a pickle with their Russia policy, where they can't be perceived as being too hardline, given the circumstances that led to Mr. Trump's presidency. But largely, those problems are away from the Korean Peninsula, in Crimea and Ukraine and all sorts of other places where the Russian state is up to no good.
Let me add an additional feature. It's actually there's only a 12-mile border that Russia has, you know, alongside.
And allegedly they're beefing that up.
And one of the strengths that allowed Kim Il-sung, the leader of North Korea for generations, was that he could play off Moscow and Beijing. And that was very, very helpful, neither on one side nor the other, working with one, working with the other. And what has happened is a little bit like Fidel in a somewhat different circumstance, is North Korea is that much more isolated. North Korea may be a repressive regime, but for the people who run that regime, they want to stay in power. These people are survivors. I do not think they are likely to do anything that will set off an explosion. They're developing nuclear weapons to ensure their future. Having said that, rational decision-making isn't always there when wars explode. Wars can explode by accident. But I think the North Korean regime wants to survive.
I was an Army wife in the 70s, and my husband was at West Point when the two Korean captains, or the two American captains, were killed on the DMZ.
Yeah.
And so we were acutely aware of what could happen there. The other thing is, do you think it's time that we taught the American public what our relationship with Korea, and it wasn't split, from 1875 to present, so Americans could kind of understand why all this is happening?
Okay, we're going to ask you to turn your radio down, Cindy, and go ahead, Stephen.
I'm not sure particularly what she was referring to, if it wasn't the Korean attack on the American ship and then the American, you know, attack on Korea. I mean, there were a couple of incidents in that period.
I think Cindy was talking about the old history of our relations.
Well, that is actually in the 1870s.
Yeah.
Well, there is a party of soldiers that were clearing brush in the DMZ, right?
We're talking about
afterwards.
She's referring to,
right.
She said 1875, I think.
And then she jumped ahead.
Both of those things are happening. But I've got to tell you, the DMZ and the Panmunjom, you know, when I went to Panmunjom, I had to sign a document that said I would not sue the American army if the North Korean troops killed me. Though I remember thinking, if they kill me, I won't be suing anybody. But I had to fill out this very elaborate form.
Oh, I'll be darned.
There is very chance.
And
but the bottom line is, Korea was under the Japanese, as it was colonized by the Japanese in a parallel fashion as we were colonizing, for example, Hawaii. There were two major imperial powers of the late 19th century, us taking over Hawaii, and then later on the Philippines. We were conquering the Philippines as the Japanese were taking over Korea.
I guess I'm puzzled to some extent by the lack of, at least the perceived lack of leverage that the Russians have, because was it not the Russians who in the 50s gave them started to give them the little bits of technology that led to their nuclear program?
Well, then you had three communist countries, and one of which was playing off the two giants in the competition between Beijing and Moscow. But this is the collapse of communism overwhelmingly in Eastern Europe and what I call the slow move away from communism in China. These are different regimes, and nationalism is much more powerful. These are not unified sort of command economies anymore. We're living in a very different century.
Chris.
The, you know, Russian power, like British power beforehand, has waned. And so in the in some places, it's still very influential, but North Korea is just not one of them. In part, that's because the relationship with China became so much stronger for the latter part of the Cold War, and then definitely in after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991.
Our number here is 800-348-2551 on Vox Pop, joined today by Stephen Lebo and Christopher Clary and Roger in Utica. Your turn.
Yes, hello. A very interesting program. I have to agree nearly 100% with the previous caller, Robin, who said that Mr. Trump's instability is what we really have to worry about. And he has to learn that you can't carry on international diplomacy by, 140-character tweets put out at 3 o'clock in the morning after he saw something on the TV that really made him angry. But Robin's absolutely right on that. We really have to look at Mr. Trump's instability.
Thanks, Robin.
The president appears to be learning. You know, he told an interviewer that Xi Jinping talged to him for 10 minutes, and gee willikers, he realized the situation was more complicated than he thought. This is true for lots of part of international life. Things seem pretty clear, and then you think about it for about 10 minutes, and it seems a lot more complicated.
But
he'll learn.
Go ahead. Let's go back to that specific question that issue was just brought up. Xi Jinping played Donald Trump. Yes, in ancient Korean history, in North Korea, like in North Vietnam, the regimes in the North seem to be so directly connected to China, it's not clear if they are a Chinese version, a Confucian version of Korea, or they were really directly controlled. But the bottom line is that about 5 years ago, Beijing started putting out maps claiming much of North Korea based on this kind of uncertain history that I just said a minute ago. Beijing has been setting up a claim that they have a claim to parts of North Korea. And I think that what happened in Florida was that Xi Jinping told Donald Trump that. Donald Trump announced it and opened up that whole area. Xi Jinping set up Donald Trump to quote him on that. And this started before Donald Trump was even in power. Actually, it was about the time Xi Jinping was coming into power. That was putting in a chit in an argument of Korea, North Korea collapses.
All right, let's go to Len in Clifton Park. Len, you're on.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that I think that Obama's foreign policy is, I agree he's a bit different, but his foreign policy is a whole lot stronger and better than Obama. Obama let that red line go by in Syria, and Trump was correct. If he had bombed them then, he wouldn't be in the pickle now. He made a deal with the Russians, and the net result is Vladimir beat him badly and got a base in Syria. It's just incredible. I agree he's his own worst enemy. But the other thing is, people forget, he surrounded himself with top-notch people. General Mattis is absolutely outstanding. General McMaster, absolutely outstanding. And Tillerson's turned out to be a hell of a lot better than anybody ever expected.
Okay, so let's parse what you said. We only got a couple of minutes here. So Len's contention, the Trump foreign policy,
better,
stronger than Obama's. And let our panel have a look at this.
Well, let's take a look at two different things. One of the main things that came out of the Vietnam War was a recognition that you didn't go to war unless you had large numbers of people in America behind you. Obama comes into power years later on a mandate to pull out of those wars of Southwest Asia and the invasion of Iraq. He was elected to do that. The Syria thing comes up. And while the red line was clearly, I think, a bad choice on his part early on his administration, he didn't have the support of the Republicans or the Democrats, and
he could have gone ahead and bombed them, but instead,
he was elected to back out.
And Vladimir beat him every step of the way.
Okay, man. All right, Len, let's let these guys talk, but thank you, Len. Go ahead, Chris.
The reality is it's tough to begin a bombing campaign with an open-ended commitment when there was no interest in Congress and no interest, by the way, from a certain private citizen named Donald Trump in 2013 either in intervening in Syria. So, there's a debate continually about whether foreign policy mistakes happen because good people let bad people get away with things, or whether foreign policy mistakes happen because good people scare other good people into doing bad things.
I think it's detrimental to always continue to point the finger backwards to whatever administration. But you had said yourself that 2006 is when this North Korean nuclear program began to ramp up. Could Obama have done anything differently, I should say?
You know, in my assessment, the reality of having a very large capital city in South Korea so close to the DMZ and having lots of North Korean artillery with conventional and chemical warheads that they can shoot at Seoul means that there have been very few options for U.S. presidents for decades,
and
certainly since 2006.
I would say that the combination of threats and the combination and compromises and assurances played out at least in the late 1990s, Kim Dae-jung, Clinton, Kim Jong-il, and as we saw in Iran, the straight, I'm going to threaten you, I'm going to blow you up unless you do this or that, doesn't work very well.
Of course,
Obama came into power trying to improve relations.
Of course, history will be the judge if that actually worked in Iran.
Or my friends will just write it out.
All right, we're done. Stephen Lebo, thank you. Good luck with the new books and the appearance. Hey, Christopher Clary, well done. Your first time on the show?
That's right.
Okay, I assume you're now traumatized and we'll never see you again. But
I'm addicted.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, thanks for being here. Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, presenting John Freeman Gill, author of The Gargoyle Hunters, Friday, June 2nd, University Club of Albany. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. Vision XL Eye Care, Lake Katrine, exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and now new American-made frames where eyewear is an art. VisionXLEyeCare.com. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years, cndharchitects.com. And the Poughkeepsie Farm Project, working to connect food, farm, and community. Organically grown CSA shares now available for the 2017 season, farmproject.org. Well, that was a fun show. Thanks again to Stephen Lebo and Christopher Clary for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for the great calls today. Really great questions, and we appreciate that from everybody. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Phones were answered by Susie Chekai. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, we'll discuss the best way to save and pay for college. Right now, though, stand by for news.